You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello, listeners, and welcome to another damn fine cup of culture. This morning, I'm joined by Matt.
Hi there. Hey, Julie.
And we have are giving movies a second chance today. So films that we watched we thought would be worth a rewatch to see if we've changed our minds about them or whether we still either hate them or love them as much as the first time we saw them. So that brings up the question, some people just don't rewatch movies at all. I mean, how about you, Matt? Do you rewatch obsessively sometimes a little bit?
I wouldn't say obsessively, but I am definitely an avid rewatcher. I even think that sometimes I prefer rewatching films and even TV series, although those less so, simply because it takes so much time. So yeah, I sometimes think I prefer rewatching things to watching new things. How about you?
Well, it depends, but there are movies that I've watched like so many times. I used to watch Goodfellas almost once a year, every year, because it just came up. I've watched some films in different iterations. You can think of Star Wars, for instance, the olden ones, which have changed, or different cuts of films. And sometimes I just really like rewatching, for instance, Lynch's Dune, which is not considered normally to be a very good movie, which I've seen like so many times. Because why? I don't know. Because it sort of engages me in some way. And some movies are just basically one-offs. You see them once and you're like, okay, that was nice.
I think it's this thing where, you know, some people watch movies or read books just for the plot, and that's absolutely okay, no problem with that. But for me, I think a movie and a book and a TV series can also be like music, and no one would say, why do you listen to a piece of music or a song more than once? No one would even ask the question. Obviously, songs don't have plots in the same sense, but for me, it's the same thing, you know, if I like how it makes me feel, what it makes me think, then obviously I'm going to rewatch it. So I think for me, movies are not that different from music in that respect.
That's a very good point. And it is true, though, because as you change, as sometimes you view certain movies, especially well-made movies, in very different ways than you did when you first saw them. I mean, Tarantino, case in point, when Pulp Fiction came out and we first saw it at the cinema, I vividly remember being in the intermission and asking my friend who I was with, what the heck am I watching here? And then you sort of discover the film over and over again, and you see things that you may have missed the first time. I mean, it's really worth going in depth with films like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, for me, it's really those two things. Sometimes, and I would say probably most often, it's that I want to get back into the mood of a film. But yeah, very often it's also that I enjoy discovering new aspects. And the thing is also, you know, some films I first watched when I was 12, 15, perhaps 20, and now I'm not 12, 15, or 20.
No.
And obviously I would expect my perspective to have changed on based on being older, but also based on having seen more films of that genre, more films by that and that director with those actors. And all of that changes my perspective. So with a good film, you can't step into the same film twice, so to speak. No. It's always a different film. But even if it's a film that is the same repeatedly, I can also just enjoy, as you said, the craftsmanship. I mean, Die Hard, I think, is a good example there. I don't think the Die Hard that I watch now is, you know, markedly different from the one I first watched when I was a teenager. But it's just, it's so much fun to see something that well-crafted. Or Raiders of the Lost Ark, same thing.
Mm.
I would say that if I disliked something, I'm much less likely to revisit it. Unless I either feel there's something there I didn't get, or sometimes it's also I hear or read from a lot of people that they really like it, or they find something about it really interesting. And that makes me sometimes think that there's something I missed.
Right, right. It's the same for me. You have these, I watch a lot of old movies. Mm-hmm. And you have these biases, right?
Yeah.
And there's a movie that you've watched, you're like, it's just not my genre, or it's just not my thing. And then you read some brilliant film historian who wrote for the Criterion, who wrote a beautiful article, and you're like, shoot, I really have to sort of go back because I've obviously missed the sense of love that people have for this picture. It's really very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, do you change your mind often, Matt?
No, because I'm always right the first time.
Mm.
And we're not just talking about films here. No, I do change my mind, but I don't think it happens all that often. I think very often, even when I revisit films, it's similar. What happens sometimes, there's some films I really enjoy the first couple of times, but I can kind of wear a film out. You know, some films just don't have the substance, and I'm not even talking about depth here. You know, I think something like some of the Marvel movies that I really enjoyed, and I sometimes watch them second time, third time, you're on a plane, there's not much on, you might watch Endgame yet again. And I find that with those, there's diminishing returns, which is also okay, because in a way they're meant to be a series, and you kind of watch the next one and the next one. But I sometimes find that I really enjoy a film, and then I find out that the third time I watch it, it has worn off, and that's disappointing. That kind of thing happens more often to me. It happens relatively rarely that I dislike a film and I go back to it and I suddenly love it.
Yeah, because that's a feeling thing, right? You can intellectually say, okay, I have now an appreciation for a film that I didn't have before. But it's really hard to change your feelings about a film, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what can sometimes happen is that I realize I expected the wrong things from a film. And that can, of course, completely change how you take in a film, your experience of the film. And I think that's probably going to come up in this discussion. I think sometimes I dislike a film because it's just not very good at what it does. It's not very well made. I might watch an adventure film and I think, couldn't I rather be watching Indiana Jones that just does this kind of thing much, much better? Sometimes it's also I don't like what a film is trying to do, and that can, of course, change. And sometimes it's just that I go into a film based on the trailers, based on the directors, based on what I've seen of it, and sometimes it's just based on what mood I'm in. I expect one thing, I get something completely different, and I think, nah. And when I then think about it afterwards, I think, actually, it's not you, the film. It's me, the person watching the film, so to speak.
Yeah, it's very dependent on expectations. I remember when Sweeney Todd came out, that's basically the sort of Grand Guignol musical that Tim Burton did with Johnny Depp. I kind of loved it. It has issues, but I kind of loved it. But people really hated, like viscerally detested this little musical horror movie. And I was like, why? And I figured it was because they were expecting a Tim Burton, Johnny Depp, Helena Bonham Carter film. And they were just not expecting them to start singing with the kabuki makeup and everything. It's just so stylized. And I wondered how many of the audience who went to see that film ever saw Sweeney Todd the musical at all.
Yeah.
Were they even expecting a musical? Because when you watch the trailers back then, it wasn't like 100% clear what we were dealing with. And I think what you're saying is right. It can even influence the success of a movie that expectations are mismanaged right at the beginning.
Oh, yeah, totally. Although, I mean, that's something that very rarely happens to me simply because I am... You talked about obsession earlier on. Do I obsessively rewatch? What I do is I obsessively read up on films that I go and see. Not all of them, but usually when I walk into a film, I know what's expecting me. I know based on the directors, I know based on some reviews I've read. I don't really mind spoilers that much. So very often I go into a film and I know what's going to happen roughly. I don't mind because again, like with music, you know, you can't spoil a song in that sense.
No, it ends with an E major.
Exactly.
Total spoiler. Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Now it's ruined. I can never listen to that song again. But at the same time, that also means that kind of experience where you go into a movie blind and you have no idea what's going to come up and you're surprised. It happens to me very rarely. I think Matt Solisites, the movie critic, he just posted something on Twitter exactly to that effect. You know, how often do we go into a film and we have no idea what expects us? And he said that critics very rarely do that. With me, that's also very rarely the case. It happens more often on TV. My wife might say, you know, this and that film is on TV. Shall we record it? We record it and I watch it and I think, oh, wow, that's totally different from what I expected. Unless it's Tommy, of course, which gives away the entire movie at the beginning with a whole screen of text telling you what's going to happen.
Yeah, true. Shall we go on to the movies that we had a rethink about today?
Absolutely. I mean, we've got two films that we've given second chances, so let's find out what happened there. Julie, which film did you give a second chance?
I brought you Mildred Pierce, which is the sort of noir melodrama, Joan Crawford, Oscar-winning, big women's picture.
Mm-hmm.
It's really unfair to call it a women's picture. But it is a picture about women's issues, very sort of clearly. And I remember when I watched it the first time, of course, it's a very old film.
Mm-hmm.
I really did not get why this even won an award. You're like, yeah, she's good, right?
Mm.
So what is it with this movie? It made me very irritable. It made me angry. I thought it was, you know, misguided. So I thought, okay, of course, since I've learned a lot about this film, so this was not entirely like a fresh rewatch in the sense that in these 20 years, I have never read anything ever again about Mildred Pierce. It's just not true. But I thought I'd bring this one for my rewatch because there are a couple of really great melodramas that I responded to in the same way the first time I saw them that I've also changed my mind about. So it's a bit of a genre thing for me as well.
Absolutely. I mean, in terms of genre, I think it is a film that can throw you for a loop because you go in and you get a murder mystery. It starts with a murder. It starts with a killing. So you go in and you expect crime, and then you realize that's basically a frame story for a story about a woman who gets divorced and basically goes on to have a life after divorce, which is not something I expected from films of that time.
No, and she gets punished for it, of course. I mean, and this is something that when I was a young movie watcher, this is something that annoyed me about these melodramas, is that these women do something right and they get punished for it. They make a mistake, they get punished for it. They live their lives and they get punished for it. They exist and they get punished for it. And this is, I think, a hard thing to wrap your mind around because Mildred Pierce, of course, exhibits what we would rightly think of as virtues. Independence, she's hardworking, she's smart, and she gets punished for it constantly. This is the same thing, I think, in the book, where just nothing can ever go right for this woman, no matter what she does. But in the book, she is a bit more of a hot mess, right? In the film, she's clearly meant to be virtuous, and her one sort of vice that ruins her life is her love for her daughter, which is basically also a sort of inverted virtue. So she gets punished for virtues and faults alike. And the same thing goes, I think, for a lot of these melodramas. Think of now Voyager. Well, what does she do wrong exactly to be denied love in her life, mm-hmm. right? It's not that. So I think it's they are admirable films, but they are also films that are quite hard to love in a modern setting, I think, because we no longer expect the film script to punish their protag for basically making the right decisions.
I'm kind of curious, when you rewatched it, did you still feel that she was being punished to the same extent and in the same way?
Yes. Absolutely, because it's turned around. Because Crawford is such a strong personality, such a strong actress, she is being punished for being her, which I think is a very woman in the 50s way to exist.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot be outside the boundaries of housewifery and marriage because the world will eat you up and spit you out. And this is what the great thing is about these films about women's issues, is that this is basically a truth that they're talking about. You can't think, okay, I'm going to make it on my own because the world will punish you for it. So I still have the same sense, but it has a different feeling underneath it.
Okay. No, it's really interesting because I didn't get that from the film to the same extent. And I wonder whether that is because I lack the context of the 50s, because you're definitely much more knowledgeable about the films of that era. I mean, I definitely think that for me, it was actually, to some extent, the opposite, you know. I couldn't remember a film from that time where we see a woman who basically tells her husband to hit the road, Jack, because he's got an affair, and he does so. She's stronger than the husband. She goes off and starts a business. I mean, first she basically goes off and becomes a working woman, and then she starts a business, and the business is successful, and first there's one restaurant, then there's two, there's three, there's four. To some extent, I actually saw this as a rags-to-riches story, which I obviously had not seen from that time about a woman.
Yeah.
So I agree, there are things that go wrong, but everything that goes wrong is in her personal life to begin with. And yes, it's partly because, you know, she's got this blind love for her daughter Vida, who's a complete sociopath.
Yeah, psycho.
Exactly. And then she goes for a kind of man who also gives her this illusion of, you know, having climbed socially, which is so weird. I mean, I think this is something that's difficult for me to watch as a present-day audience and understand. This is a woman who basically goes from being a housefrau to being a divorcee to being a successful businesswoman. which even in the present day, you know, is not something that's an everyday thing. But at the same time, she seeks social validation by basically finding a lover who's, you know, this kind of nouveau riche, or perhaps not that nouveau, semi-nouveau as American riche get, who's kind of upper class, but he's a complete phony. So I think that's the part that I find very dated, and I find that very dated to begin with. Other than that, I find it, strangely enough, to be a success story.
Yeah, it sort of harkens back to films like The Divorcee, which is much older,
mm-hmm.
where, and you see this cycle in the film as well, where sort of the happiness comes from the marriage, even if the marriage is flawed, which is something that still annoys me, because her husband in the film, in Mildred Pierce, is like this sort of, I don't know, plank of wood.
Mm-hmm.
This passionless, gruff, almost angry, irritated man. Okay, so she leaves him, but then in the end, of course, she has to come back with him, if only for 3 minutes. And this sort of harkens back to The Divorcee, where you also have this wonderful speech about why are the rules different for men than for women. But in the end, of course, she has to go back to her no good drunk of a husband, because marriage is the one happiness that a woman is supposed to strive for. So these films are trying in very clever little ways to escape. So stay within the frame. They try to sort of peek out of it a little bit. And it's very, very strongly implied that her affair that she has, or her fling that she has, is a bad thing because her daughter dies just after. There's no literal causality, but the film implies that all these sort of disasters pile up on her because she has been promiscuous.
Mm-hmm. That is true. That is there. And strangely enough, you know, there's an HBO miniseries that they did about 10 years ago with Kate Winslet. And there I felt that even more strongly, obviously also because the sex was more explicit. I mean, they basically go off to have sex and she comes back and her kid, the saintly kid, not the psycho kid, is, you know, close to dying and then she dies. And yes, that it's very difficult to read that differently. Absolutely.
Yeah. So in the beginning, I thought she was being punished by the film and it was kind of cruel. But now later in life, now I know a little bit more. I'm a little bit more grown up too, but also I've read a little bit more. It's the film's subversiveness that now stands out to me rather than its conventions. Mm-hmm. So the way that it tries to escape. By casting Joan Crawford to begin with, she is like the epitome working strong woman. She does that in a few movies. This is not the only example. This is just one of the more prominent ones. That you get this in this subversion within the context of the melodrama. I mean, look at Humoresque, for instance. I don't even know how to pronounce that. It deals with issues that it could not have dealt with if it were a quote-unquote serious drama. Mm-hmm. That these women's melodramas are able, because they're not taken too seriously or weren't taken too seriously at the time, to deal with issues that you couldn't do in a more mainstream setting, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think to some extent that also goes back to, you remember the discussion you had with Alan a couple of months ago about the pre-code films?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now we're at a time in Hollywood movie making where if they want to be subversive, they have to hide that or code it. And I think that's one of those things that's always difficult when going back to those films, to older films, especially if you lack the context to some extent, as I do much more than you do. Just do you see in a way, what's on the surface, which often seems very conservative, or do you see the subversion that's just underneath the surface? And I think when I watched Mildred Pierce, I was lucky that I saw the subversion more than the conservative surface, which is also perhaps why I enjoyed it to begin with. But I'm wondering, I mean, you said that women's films are generally looked down upon more so, and I think that's absolutely true. Do you think that's also why they put in the crime story? Because in the original novel, there's no murder. None of that happens.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think it signals that they're doing something completely different than the book.
Mm-hmm.
This framing device where there's a murder that never ever even happens in the book. I think in the book she nearly kills the Vida, the psycho kid.
Mm-hmm.
In the film she slaps her, but I think in the book she nearly kills her, and that's the only thing. So this entire murder doesn't happen. And I think it's a framing device to show us that we're on a very different path to what you might expect. It's a way to mess with our expectations. Because after this sort of crime opening where you hear the bang and you see the body and you see her walking along the quay contemplating suicide, which is a very Joan Crawford melodrama-y thing, in her furs and with her tears you know, down her face like little diamonds with her perfect hair and a perfect face. I don't know. When I cry, I don't look that good. Really, I don't. Obviously, she survives, but I think it's a way to mess with our expectations to the extent that we can watch this movie with a fresh look instead of being drawn into the book again. In what way does it follow the book? Because the book is too explicit for the time to be put to be filmed. It's almost, I think there's this sort of weird incesty thing. So it couldn't be filmed anyway. So this is a nice way to say, okay, we're going into noir territory straight away. Only Mildred is not our femme fatale. Right? So it's a little bit of, that's how I see it. I may be completely wrong, but that's my take.
I mean, it's really, I still think it's fascinating how it smushes these two ultra-American genres together. You know, the kind of melodrama, rags to riches, you know, successful businesswoman, and the kind of almost noir-y thing. In that respect, it's fascinating that the novel is much more the melodrama, much less the crime thing. Yet it was written by James M. Cain, who, of course, wrote stuff like The Postman Always Rings Twice and Double Indemnity. Yeah. So you expect it to be with a, you know, you expect the murder. I mean, in that respect, I definitely would recommend to anyone listening to this who's seen the 1945 film to go and seek out the HBO miniseries. It's pretty good. Directed by Todd Haynes, as I said, stars Kate Winslet, great cast. And it's just an interesting, different take on the same story type. And I think they kind of complement each other really well.
Yeah, it's interesting that Mildred Pierce, of all the books, at least the ones that I know of Cain's, is that that's the most sort of conventionally melodramatic one. Whereas a film, it's quite a subversive, iconic image. I mean, when we think of Mildred Pierce, we think of this strong self-made woman. Talk about your American storylines, by the way. Self-made woman runs into old classist biases. But in the book, not so much, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that this film stands very much on its own as an icon of Joan Crawford's career as well. I mean, could almost be, it's not, but it could almost be biographical, or you could imagine that this has something to do with Crawford herself, who is self-made.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's an interesting watch, and I know it takes a little bit of contextualizing, and I know that the current Twitterati thing that this usually too much work, but I do say jump in because there's so much to enjoy in this sort of stuff.
Absolutely. So on the whole, would you say you went from hating it to loving it, or is it a bit more nuanced?
Well, it's hard for me to have a feeling. I'm not of that time. I'm a modern woman, right? So it's hard for me to have a feel for it like I would have if I'd seen it in the cinema when it came out. I never lived that context.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't appreciate it as it deserved to be appreciated because I was too young, I was too snooty, and I didn't understand what this film was trying to do. And with a little bit of context, it's really a very sort of, I wouldn't call it groundbreaking, it's too tame for that, but a very iconic picture. So my appreciation of it like quadrupled, but it's hard to have a real feeling for it in, you know, 2021.
Yeah. Out of interest, how old were you when you first saw it?
Must have been about 22.
Okay.
When I had the classic movie binge thing and it won an Oscar, right? Mm-hmm. You sort of go back through internet and go like, okay, which movies have I never seen that everybody says are so awesome? And this is one of the sort of stack of films that I sort of watched out of a sense of, well, a little bit of a sense of duty, which is not going to help my appreciating the film.
Yeah. I think that's one thing I've found, that, you know, a lot of the black and white films that I've seen, I first saw when I was, you know, when I was a kid on TV, they probably bought a lot of these films and they were cheap because they were old. So you could show, you know, the whole Frank Capra back catalog, all of the Hitchcocks, all of that. Lots of these black and white films, I saw them when I was that age. And at that age, you don't second guess it. You just watch the film and you enjoy it for what it is. It tells a story about these people. Sometimes people get killed. Sometimes people get together. I think I only started becoming more critical of the conservative elements in these films, and also perhaps a bit more. I only started feeling that it's really difficult to get into these films when I was probably a late teenager in my 20s, because that's also when I'd seen more modern films and the whole context changed. So I think in some ways, it's best if you first watch these films when you're 8 years old and they're on TV and on a Sunday afternoon and it's rainy.
And you don't know what to expect, mm-hmm. which is every generation has expectations. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, even for me, it's sort of, and I love these old movies, but it's really hard to sort of really feel the pressures that, well, for example, women were under, not to mention people of color. You know these things, but it's hard to get a sort of feeling for it all these years, decades, sometimes later.
Yeah.
Because the world has changed dramatically.
Absolutely.
All right. You brought us it now, you know, old movies. I love old movies, but you've brought us a film too.
Yeah, it's not quite as old. What I brought is Killing Them Softly from 2012, directed by Andrew Dominik. He also adapted it from a novel, Coogan's Trade, by George V. Higgins, who might be famous to fans of crime movies and crime fiction as the guy who wrote The Friends of Eddie Coyle, which was adapted by Peter Yates and starred Robert Mitchum. Killing Them Softly is very much a film that when I saw it at the cinema, I didn't like it. I didn't like it quite a bit.
You really, really did not like that film.
Yeah, you could say that. And it's not even that I hated it. I think what happened was that, you know, the director had previously done The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford.
Oh, yeah.
And that, I would still say, is one of my favorite films. I'm not even that much into Westerns, but that is definitely my favorite Western, and it is probably in my top three favorite films. And I think that is exactly what happened. I went into Killing Them Softly, having seen a film by Andrew Dominik starring Brad Pitt, and I expected something that would feel similar. You know, again, I said music. You know, if you have a, I don't know, for instance, a band that you really like, or a singer-songwriter, and you like one of their albums and you buy the next album, of course you don't expect it to be exactly the same, but you expect it, or at least I expect it, to give me the same kind of feeling. And if the first one was more kind of folksy, melancholic, and then the next one is poppy and electronic, I'm going to suffer from whiplash to some extent, and I'm going to find it difficult to give this a fair chance. And I think that is exactly what happened with me and Killing Them Softly, that I didn't give it a fair chance because I expected the wrong thing. You've seen it. What did you think of it?
It's very stylish, isn't it? It's one of those movies that I have a hard time getting into because it has so much style.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, Ray Liotta is in it, in this sort of quintessential stupid mafioso type way that immediately sets you on the track in the idiom of these sort of mob type crime movies. So I thought it was very stylish. To be honest with you, I didn't see the point. I mean, if you really like the Guy Ritchie type thing, that sort of rather stylized bunch of lower class wankers go on this stupid adventure and get themselves killed, it's a very stylish film.
Mm-hmm.
But it has pretenses above its station. And I think that not annoyed me, but sort of took me out of it, that it has all these political, you hear Obama talking, and I'm like, what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
So it has these aspirations of being really stylish and really intellectual. And I'm like, yeah, but it doesn't really come together at the end why this is. I mean, Brad Pitt has speech, I suppose. Almost everybody dies and then it's the end. So it's a pretty little picture, but it's certainly not Jesse James. I mean, my goodness, that's a bit of a, yeah, that's a big difference to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think that might be one of the problems, that The Assassination of Jesse James is, I would still say after the second viewing, it's the better film, clearly. It's the film that will stay with us longer. Also, I think The Assassination of Jesse James is a film that looks more like what we expect out of prestige cinema. It's poetic, it's elegiac. You know, there's a kind of seriousness there that I think it pulls off. It works well. And then you move on to Killing Them Softly. You mentioned Guy Ritchie. I think it's not quite the same because Guy Ritchie plays everything for laughs. And for instance, the violence that there is in Killing Them Softly is not played for laughs in the same extent. The violence is actually pretty horrible, totally. And I think that's the thing. Killing Them Softly is, it grates more. The Assassination of Jesse James might be too slow, too long, too poetic for some people, but it doesn't grate. Killing Them Softly is a film that doesn't, you know, it's kind of grim, but also sarcastic, and that makes it kind of unpleasant. And I think that unpleasantness is actually interesting. I mean, as I said, expectations were my problem with this film. And I think on the one hand, as I said, there's the assassination of Jesse James, which was completely the wrong thing to expect. But I think it's also I had interference from The Sopranos, which had finished only a couple of years earlier. And of course, you get that because you've got James Gandolfini in a relatively big part. You've got a couple of side characters who were also, I mean, the actors also appeared in Sopranos. As you said, you have Ray Liotta.
Yeah.
So what you get is a very different world. It's a grimy world. It's also, it's a world where everyone, as you said, they're assholes, basically.
Yeah, they are. They are absolute, complete, I'm not going to say the word, but they're absolute, complete bleeps. It's terrible. And I think in its defense, it's meant to grate.
Totally.
If you look at Gandolfini's performance, which is, it is a massively good performance. It is a great performance because he takes Tony Soprano and shows you the face of the monster that he actually is.
Mm-hmm.
Not literally Tony Soprano himself, but that sort of character where it's all, us boys and fun and hookers and drinking. And he puts this monstrous face on that. Really disgusting.
Yeah.
Which is an incredibly clever thing to do. And an incredibly horrifying thing because it is Gandolfini and you know him or his face and his acting so well. I think it cannot be any other thing than meant to shock you out of the romanticization of these kinds of crime films. So in that sense, it's trying to have it both ways. It's trying to be this really stylized, postmodern mob picture and then tries to show you the monster behind the mask. And I don't think you can have it. You can't have your cake and eat it too in that sense. But it's a shockingly good performance. I was just gaping at the screen, at the courage, at the balls of this man, playing this revolting person. It was massively, massively well done.
It's interesting. I mean, my reaction to the character was very similar to yours, but it's when I talked to my wife about it, she also said, but the guy is clearly depressive.
That too.
Which doesn't excuse him, but it kind of explains him. So I think while it shows the ugly side, it possibly even revels a tiny bit in the ugly side, but I think it does so to have a point. It is nuanced, and I think that is something that I also didn't see the first time around. You know, the first time around, I really thought it felt like subpar Goodfellas, Sopranos, pastiche, and I don't think it is that because I think it pulls it off, perhaps not as well as those films, but it pulls it off better than I gave it credit for the first time.
Yeah, and it tries something a little bit different, I think, than those films do. It's meant to draw you in this world where it's glamorized mob crime picture and then tries to yank you out of it again. And the Gandolfini character is a great example of this. It does it a couple of times, sometimes successfully, sometimes less so. But Gandolfini's character is a drinker. This is what an alcoholic looks like. The depression, the grandiosity. This is like the worst alcoholic you have ever met. And I don't mean worse in that he drinks a lot because he does that too. But in terms of all the sort of things that you associate with the disease, I mean, he must have known some drinkers in his time to be able to pull that off. And the same thing goes for Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn is a lovely, lovely actor, very sort of subdued. And here he plays a junkie. He's a funny junkie, but he's a junkie. And it's like, it's sad.
Absolutely.
But he's also a complete asshole. So it can be both. I don't know. This film could have been better than it is, I think, because it has so many little points that you're like, oh, this is, you know, this is interesting. And then it goes on to Brad Pitt in big sunglasses and you're like, yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. I think I also kind of reassessed my take on Brad Pitt in the film. I mean, the interesting thing is that I don't think the film glamorizes this gangster life at all. But the Brad Pitt character, he weirdly enough, he has a work ethic. And the work ethic does not make him into a good guy, but it makes him into the least bad guy of the bunch. And in interesting ways, you know, for instance, there's this one, the Ray Liotta character. He does something really stupid. And later on, he's punished for someone else doing something really stupid. And, you know, the Brad Pitt character basically says, look, we have to kill Marky Trautman, that's the Ray Liotta character, because having him hang around is just a liability. Mm-hmm. So we have to kill him.
It's bad for optics, right? Yeah.
Exactly. From a perspective of Brad Pitt as a professional, that is perfectly true. The Brad Pitt character also says, but we don't have to make him suffer. someone else says, can't we just beat him up? Can't we just smash in his face? We don't have to kill him. And Brad Pitt's character, Jackie, just says, look, why make him suffer when the end result is going to be the same thing? Let's be professional about this. So we've got, in a way, the one character who has a work ethic, and the work ethic is still about murder and crime and corruption, but it's not about sadism. It's not about being entitled and horrible and kind of sociopathic. And of course, what happens is that the people who decide these things say, no, we're not going to kill Marky Trattum yet. We're going to beat him up. And it's a horrible scene. It's awful. It's one of the most gruesome scenes of someone being beaten up. It feels very realistic. It's sickening. And you've got the two, you know, thugs who beat him up. They resent him because he's making them feel bad for beating him up. So they beat him up even more.
Yeah, we have some victim blaming issues there.
Absolutely. And I do think that the film is very, very astute when it comes to the psychology of these types.
Yeah, but, you know, this brings me back to Jesse James and the coward Robert Ford because of Brad Pitt, obviously. And in Jesse James, Brad Pitt uses his physical presence and his beauty, uses it as a psychopath. Because Jesse James, I'm sorry, but he's a psycho. And he's very disturbed and he gets very paranoid, etc. And this film shows us that everybody knows that this guy's a psycho, but because he has such presence, everybody forgives him or they sort of ignore it or they sort of work around it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that Pitt could have used in Killing Them Softly to great effect, that this presence and this persona that you put out in the world, this mask, can be incredibly powerful. But somehow he doesn't. He plays it as a sort of a straight script, which is his choice. And of course, he's a massively good actor. I'm not trying to criticize him. But for me, there was a huge difference of the added value of having Brad Pitt as Jesse James, because he's Brad Pitt, gosh darn it, the legend, and having Brad Pitt as this sort of very stoic assassin who says, well, why don't we shoot him immediately? What's the sense in beating someone up if he's going to be shot anyway? Which in a sense may seem professional, but of course it's heartbreaking and it's weird and it's just completely, utterly psycho. How can you even contemplate such a thing? So I think the way that these actors are used, where you use Gandolfini to perfect effect, Brad Pitt gets sort of left behind, is my sense. Am I making any sense at all,
Absolutely.
By the way, Matt, here?
No, I think that's where it comes in that, as I said, I do think that The Assassination of Jesse James is the better film because I think the material is probably richer. I do think that there's a lot to Killing Them Softly I didn't see the first time, but I also think that I agree. You know, I think Brad Pitt does a great job of the part. But I could have imagined this in the 70s being played by someone like Robert Mitchum, who I mentioned before, you know, this kind of lived-in professional. And of course, Brad Pitt, the problem with Brad Pitt is that Brad Pitt is Brad Pitt. You don't get away from that. You know, you could possibly put him in makeup like you did. You remember in Monster, where you had Charlize Theron under makeup, so she was almost unrecognizable. Obviously, you can discuss whether that, you know, should you do that or should you just cast someone who doesn't look like Charlize Theron to begin with. And Brad Pitt is just, he's iconic and that works perfectly for Jesse James. Jackie in Killing Them Softly doesn't have to be iconic. He just has to be a professional and good at his job. And that could have been played by anyone. There's no additional benefit of casting iconic Brad Pitt in that part, I would say.
Exactly, which is what's so perfect about Jesse James. Mm-hmm. Is that because we immediately associate him with this icon, the movie uses that. And it's a little bit of a missed opportunity with Killing Them Softly. And it's such a grim little film, really.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what this sort of very stylized character who sort of speaks in complete sentences is even doing in this world, right? He feels like Alice in Wonderland and it fell down the wrong rabbit hole somehow.
I mean, in some ways, I almost wonder whether it's just that, you know, Dominic and Pitt just loved working with each other. So they said, whatever we do next, let's do it together. And I do wonder, it might, you know, I think it's a good film with Brad Pitt in that part, but it might be a better film with someone who's not Brad Pitt, but someone who's more lived in.
Toned down, I suppose. It's also not a Joaquin Phoenix type role. It's a very sort of stylized dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
So it could have been anyone. And I understand totally that it's Pitt. I mean, you get to pitch your film, and you get to say to the producers, okay, we got Pitt. now you have how much more money to make your movie. Of course, you know, and anything Pitt wants to do, he gets to do. It's, and that's perfectly fine. And all of this would have been lovely if the film actually had a point to its nastiness.
I think, though, and I might be wrong here, but I think by now that it does. I think it's a bit heavy-handed. You know, as you said, there's all these, basically you got, whenever something happens, you almost have like this Greek chorus. Is it chorus, choir? I never know which one it is, chorus. You've basically got, you know, latter-day George W. Bush and pre-election Barack Obama talking about basically the financial crisis. And my take on this by now, and I don't think I saw that the first time around, is just that, like The Sopranos, I think the film takes this gangster world as a parallel to America and American business. You know, that basically you used to have, or at least you used to have this idea that business is professional. There's certain kind of principles there. Obviously, you want to make money. Obviously, you want to come out on top. But capitalism doesn't have to be corrupt. That was the past, or the idea of the past, nostalgic past. But what you have in the present day is, no, actually, it's all corrupt. Everyone's a sociopath. Everyone's out for themselves. You've got the one good businessman, the one good professional, the Brad Pitt character, and everyone else might try to tell themselves that, you know, they are good at what they do, but actually they are not. They are all children playing a violent game, and everyone suffers.
Hmm.
Does that make any sense?
I think I came to the conclusion that the moral of this film is that life's just nasty all over, isn't it? ? And is this borne out by the capitalist or anti-capitalist part, is borne out by Mendelssohn's character, who has this dog walking scheme.
Exactly.
He's a total junkie. What's he even doing caring for animals? But he thinks this is a way for him to make money and accumulate money and get rich. And of course, he is never going to get rich because he's a loser and he's a junkie.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that the rich stay rich and get richer, and the poor lead hard scrabble lives that they dream of getting out of. And the only way to get out of them is to go in for harebrained schemes that will get you killed. So this is the parallel that I got, but I think it's a spurious parallel. Not because I think capitalism is incorruptible, or because people in high places and politicians are ethical, moral beings. It is because the type of movie that you are trying to be. If you are trying to be a science fiction movie, you had better be extraordinarily clever to also be a movie about mourning or loss. And this film is not clever enough to pull off the everybody's just a big old bastard, ain't he, type conclusion. Not that I think it's a bad movie or that it sets about it in the wrong way. For me, it just, as a film watcher, it just doesn't gel in a way that gives me the idea that I learned something or I took something away from that. Of course, we know they're all bastards.
I mean, I do think it's a bit more specific than that, but I also think it's a kind of specific point that The Sopranos made for 6 seasons and they did it better. I think it's not just that everyone's a bastard, but I really think that what The Sopranos did for me was, it was very much a story about America and American capitalism, and that the mob, as depicted, is not, it's not abnormal. It's not a deviation from what capitalism should be. It's actually taking capitalism, American capitalism, to its most essential manifestation to some extent, that this is not capitalism gone wrong, but it's actually capitalism in its end state. And I think in that respect, that's what I kind of got out of Killing Them Softly the second time around. And I think that is a bit more specific than everyone's a bastard, you know, everyone's out for number one. But at the same time, as I said, I also think it's still a bit facile. In a way that, you know, The Sopranos also make that point over and over again, but by being 6 seasons long, they could also, you know, do variations on it. They could give you nuances on it. And a 2-hour movie is almost automatically gonna just say a bit less.
Yeah, but isn't it trying to do too many things as well?
Possibly.
And you have the Gandolfini inversion, just to put it that way, like being the monster or the abusive alcoholic that Tony Soprano doesn't quite get to be. And having this parallel with American capitalism in its purest sense, it's criminal. And isn't it just trying to do too many things instead of just being a cracking good movie?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, if anything, I probably came away from it thinking more like, well, duh, you know, it's, we've heard that before and we already know it. And in that respect, I think I would have preferred it without the voiceovers, because I do think that they make a point utterly obvious that in itself is not that interesting a point.
Not very novel. It's also interesting, if we go back to Mildred Pierce a little bit, that we've rewatched these films that are essentially about American life and American capitalism in very different ways, in which in the first, Mildred Pierce is the underdog mm-hmm. and tries to be becomes a self-made woman. And in Killing Them Softly, nobody becomes anything more than they already are. It's a very different take on, I'm not going to say American capitalism, because I think it's the same way everywhere in the world, but on this system where you have this ideal, this carrot of you can become better than you are, you can grow out of your circumstances. And then with Mildred, she constantly gets pushed back down, punished and spat on. And with Killing Them Softly, these poor guys just never stood a chance, did they?
Yeah, exactly. Everyone wants to become, what's his name, Tony Montana? Scarface?
Yeah.
And mostly what they end up being is Ben dead. Mendelsohn or dead. Exactly.
And even Tony Montana, don't forget, never got to be Tony Montana.
Yeah.
Because he ends up in a pretty gruesome set of circumstances as an addict and a paranoiac. So these are not themes that are new, and it's not like a complete coincidence that these themes repeat throughout these two very different films in American cinema. But I think it is interesting that we've seen capitalism as a force for not much good for a very long time, apparently, where you think, well, you know, self-made men and all that. I think there have been people in throughout the ages who just didn't really believe that. Not really. I have one more question for you,
mm-hmm.
because I have to get back to Jesse James. Now, why is it that Jesse James is just like miles, miles, miles ahead to Killing Them Softly?
I would really say it's the material. I haven't read either of the novels. I've been wanting to read The Assassination of Jesse James, but I also don't want to ruin the film to some extent. I get the impression that there's simply more interesting character dynamics to The Assassination of Jesse James. It is more epic, it is more grandiose, it is more poetic. And as I said, I do think that we tend to value that more, and not always quite fairly.
Hmm.
Here, I think it is a better film, but I think Killing Them Softly is also, it's about, what is it, 100 minutes? It is kind of a nasty joke about a nasty joke of a system.
Yeah.
And I think it doesn't want to be kind of more complex in terms of the characters and characterization. Again, you know, like The Sopranos, I think the material is just richer in one case than in the other.
Mm-hmm.
And it has led to a richer film.
Yeah, and I think what helps, because I love Jesse James more, but I think what helps is that because it's in a Western setting, I have more distance.
Mm-hmm.
Killing Them Softly, you hear Obama's literal voice speaking. It draws me much closer to the film, which makes me more critical of it. And Jesse James already has this distance, you know, what to expect with a Western, even a very grim Western, which is what this is. But you actually have some distance to grow some love for it instead of constantly being punched in the face by really horrifying violence, by really enormous cynicism. And I think that, to be fair to Killing Them Softly, this is why I appreciate Jesse James more, I think, if I'm honest about it.
Yeah. It might also be, and I'm really just guessing here because I don't know the genre quite well enough to make this point, so perhaps I should just shut up, but it might be that the Western as a genre is richer, it has a richer history. And because of that, I mean, you had kind of classic Western, you had neo-Western, you had the kind of more subversive Westerns. You have so many films in that genre of very, very, very different kinds. And I think any Western you make nowadays is going to refract and reflect and resonate with all of these films. I think there's also, of course, a rich history of mob movies and crime movies. But at the same time, I think they can more easily perhaps be put into certain kind of types. I mean, you've got the Scorsese type of mob film, which is very much, you know,
Italianate.
But also, you know, the kind of grimy, snarky, nasty. And then you've got the epic Francis Ford Coppola Godfather kind of school, which is Shakespearean. And I think a lot of the films fit into the one or the other roughly.
Yeah.
But I don't think you have quite the same richness of different types of gangster movies that each new gangster movie kind of reflects.
Yeah. And I think I want to mention this. There's a rather lovely history of Australian Westerns, which has been almost forgotten because they were banned at some point. And I'm not going to go too deeply into this, but Jesse James seems to draw on that outback type, these enormous landscapes, this vast emptiness. As a Western, there seems to almost be an atavistic element to it. And this is something I think that we don't associate with a crime genre. It's always dirty urban places. Like this was shot, The Killing Them Softly was shot in New Orleans.
Okay.
I wouldn't have noticed if I hadn't read about it. So you don't have this huge canvas to work with, which you do in Westerns. I mean, The Mandalorian is basically a Western. It's just about the scope of the canvas, basically. And with crime, you're narrowing your frame quite a bit. I think that also doesn't help. Well, something to close off with, which is interesting. This is something you came up with, Matt. Why is it that sometimes films that are really good films, I mean, there's nothing wrong with them. We watch them and we're like, ugh, you know, really not for me. I mean, why do you get that?
Such a big question.
It's a bit of a big question.
I mean, I really do think that in this case, it was the wrong expectations. If the film hadn't been by Andrew Dominik, if I'd seen it before the assassination of Jesse James, I would have seen it differently. I would have probably liked it better the first time. But then, you know, again, I come back to music. I would say that there's a lot of good music out there that just doesn't resonate with me. And I think films can be the same thing. I mean, there's a bunch of films and directors I want to revisit. And I hope that we will actually continue revisiting them also in the podcast, possibly. I'm thinking, for instance, of Jean-Luc Godard.
Mm-hmm.
So far, I've not really liked any Jean-Luc Godard. I liked one almost, and there's bits I liked about the others. But at the same time, there's something that rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah.
And I don't know, is it just that I'm watching it wrongly? So I honestly think that if something is truly good, truly interesting, it's not going to appeal to everyone. I think something that everyone likes is actually going to be less interesting.
I agree with that. I also think to add to your, because you make some very good points, a lot of it to me is about context.
Mm-hmm.
It's like what I said about Mildred Pierce. When I first watched that, I lacked all sorts of context to see this film. And I'm not saying that you have to do your homework before being able to watch a film. A film should be compelling. And it's, you know, you don't have to read really big books by Jeanine Basinger to understand it. But I do think that sometimes it's really worth it to have a little bit of context that you bring into the film. The same thing goes for Jesse James with me, is that when I first saw it, I thought it was a very beautiful Western, epic type thing. And as I learned a little bit more, now I watched it with an appreciation that I just didn't have before. And I didn't change my mind about it. I thought it was good, and I still think it was good, even a little bit overlong. But my own knowledge about the genre sort of deepens my appreciation of the film. And I do think it's worth it before you write off a film as a viewer, before you say, oh, it's just crap, to, you know, put a little bit of effort into it, especially if other people that you respect say it's good, and try a little harder, because I think sometimes it's really, especially with old films, it really is worth it.
Absolutely.
Any famous last words, Matt?
I think probably just that, you know, most likely second chances will return.
Yeah, let's hope so.
I think we're going to give the format a second and third chance possibly as well, also in different setups, because there's lots of films out there that might be better than we noticed the first time around.
Oh, definitely. For now, this has been a Damn Fine Cup of Culture podcast. Thank you so much for listening. And please do join us next time. Goodbye.
Bye.